All right, we're going to crank up here, and let's open with a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for your love, your invasion in the history and the person of your Son, the beauty of his heart, the consistency of his commitment to us, the gentleness, and yet at the same time his firmness with getting the work done, Lord, for going straight to the cross for us and showing us what love is about and acceptance and freedom. We thank you for the Word of God and its clarity, its light in a dark place. We ask that you would help us tonight to see things and in your Word and understand more of the background of this Easter season, that we would have a greater and greater appreciation for the love and the work of your Son and the beauty of your heart and the and all that's available because of that. So bless our time tonight and as we look into this background material and your Word, we ask this for your Son's sake, that we would fall more and more in love with him. Amen. Okay, we've got just a couple of things to go through first. If you'll just look at the invitation thing that's got the little outline that was on the cover of the book, I just was going to talk about what we're going to cover each one of the sessions. So tonight, March 7th, we're going to talk about before the Last Supper. So this is actually about Holy Week, and Holy Week starts on Palm Sunday. And in the history of the New Testament, Palm Sunday, that Holy Week, was Passover week. And so if you visualize, we will do some visualizing of Jerusalem. All the people, all the Jews from all over the world converged on Jerusalem that week. So when Jesus goes in on that Sunday, there's already a crowd there that's already traveled from Galilee and from Egypt and from Syria, all there to celebrate the Passover that Friday morning. So they all come in. The Jewish males were supposed to come in three times a year to Jerusalem from wherever they lived. And so it's obviously Passover is one of the premier Jewish holidays and has always been since the Exodus. And so the crowds, Jerusalem is filled with people. And correspondingly, the government is on call. So all the police people and all the military people that normally would live in other cities during the regular year, they're all there for Passover for crowd control. So Pilate's going to be there. Normally he wouldn't be there. Herod's going to be there. Normally he wouldn't necessarily be there. But everything is very high tension. A lot of rumors about this Jesus of Nazareth. He's been to Jerusalem a couple times before. Everybody knows about him. Everybody knows about John the Baptist and what's happened with him and him being beheaded by one of the leaders and things of his type. And so that last week is where all of the gospel material comes to a head. The gospel material, of course, you know, starts with before the birth of Christ and goes all the way through his life and generally focuses on the last 3 years. Well, a full third of all of the Gospels is just the last week. So we're not going to come close to being able to cover everything that happened in that week, in that last week. But we're going to hit the high points and the major things that have the most historical significance and background, so that as you're thinking about the Easter experiences, and as you hear sermons from pastors and see material of this type, you'll see how the background fits that and how it illuminates that. So the he goes in on a Sunday, roughly on the donkeys that we'll talk about. He goes in and the crowd's all excited, and the first couple of days up until like Thursday are mostly him teaching in the temple. And so he'll be like, you know, everybody converges on the big temple. And so the crowds are all there. It's festive and everything like that. And then there's everybody likes to hear gossip and news and things of this type and the latest teaching and what rabbi is disagreeing with what other rabbi and things of this type. And Jesus will spend a lot of his time speaking there, teaching in the temple. And then at night, he will withdraw from the city, outside the city limits, and he'll meet with his disciples and he'll privately teach them other things. And not just his 12, there would be about 100 people that would follow him, you know, from different places. And, of course, there'd be family from Galilee down that he probably would have visited with, too, and things of his type. And then we get the Last Supper, which is a pre-Passover Passover on that Thursday night. And that'll be the last, what we know is the Last Supper and the institution of communion. And then on Friday will be the crucifixion. And then Saturday, basically the Sabbath, will be the quiet day when he's in the tomb. Okay, and it's the Jewish Passover holy day where nobody can sort of travel around. And then on Sunday we get the Easter morning experience. So those we'll concentrate on those events as we go through this. So tonight the first thing we're going to talk about are the various players. So we're going to talk about who Pontius Pilate was, and who Herod and the Sadducees and the Pharisees, the Sanhedrin and the chief priests. So we'll know who the actors are on this stage, because they all play in and out of these events. So it's very intense during this period. We're going to talk about those, and then we're going to try to cover Jesus' claims to authority. So there's four specific events of his teaching that occurred in that first day or two that really tripped the trigger that brought everything to a head. So when he claims to have the authority over all these other religious authorities, and it becomes very clear in the face of all Judaism who's now there for the feast, that he's claiming to be the Son of God, the Messiah, the true King of Israel, the ultimate high priest, etc., that there's a conflict in the making. And it is that conflict that eventuates, from a human perspective, in the arrest and the crucifixion. So tonight, we're going to try to cover who the players are and what it was that finally, the straw that broke the camel's back with his religious leader opponents. So that's what we're going to try to do tonight. On the 4th, we will start at the Last Supper. So we will talk about Judas. When Judas makes the decision to betray the Lord, we'll talk about the plot to kill Jesus, Judas's bargain with the high priest, you know, the 30 pieces of silver and that incident. We'll talk about the Last Supper, which was had a Passover Seder in it, a Passover process. We'll talk about the cups and the wine and the bread and things of this type. We'll talk about the washing of the disciples' feet, which was the most important event for the Lord in trying to communicate finally to them what God was like. We'll talk about what happened in the Garden of Gethsemane, where it was, how big it was, things of this type. And then the betrayal and arrest. The arrest in the garden in the darkness, where Judas leads the police force and they arrest Jesus and then take him on all these night trials. On his last night on earth, before his crucifixion. And so that will be next week. Then the 21st, we will cover, the rest of this will cover the next roughly 12 hours, 12 to 18 hours. We'll talk about the trials. He goes through approximately at least six trials. Generally, it's more like eight. But he's tried before two high priests, Jewish leaders, Pilate twice, Herod once, and then we'll describe parts of the crucifixion. Not a lot of it. I mean, that can go on forever, the detail of that. But we'll just talk about the relevant historical pieces of that, and then the burial. What did it mean for somebody to put 75 pounds of spices on him? You know, there were a couple of rich people that gave him their tomb. What was the significance of that? And what did that mean for his acceptance and things of this type? And then the last and or last and a half, we'll cover actually what happened that Easter morning. In other words, when at daybreak, when the Sabbath was over on Sunday morning and people were now free to leave their homes, the Sabbath was over. The women run to the tomb first, and they will describe what happened at the tomb, the guards that were there. We'll talk about some of the appearances to the disciples, and then at the end we'll back up and we'll say what God saw. How did God see this week? He was the one that orchestrated this from the prophecies of Isaiah 53 and Psalm 22. This was no accident. I mean, this was an incredibly beautiful love plan to free us. And so, I mean, we'll look at specifically these. We'll go back through these events and say, what did God feel there? What was his understanding of that? What do we know from that? So that's going to be the sequence of what we're going to go through here, so that as you hear Easter messages, you know, in church and Sunday school and think about these things, you'll be able to see how it sort of played out there in front of you in terms of the visuals, okay? Now, the next thing we're going to do is, we're through with the invite. On the inside of your binder, you have a little, on the inside cover, you've got some maps. Okay, and I want to take us through the maps because these are important for us to see roughly what we're looking at. So that first map is a map, a top-down picture of what Jerusalem looked like at the time of Jesus. So it's this one. And you'll see it's, the little brown is the wall, the outside wall. So the walls of Jerusalem would be that brown thing around the edge, not the purple, but the brown. And this thing in the top right, the big rectangular, is the temple area. Okay? Now, if you remember, David wanted to build a temple. Remember when they came out of the Exodus, the Ark of the Covenant was in a tent, right? And so they carried it on like a stretcher, and it was on a tent. And the tabernacle in the wilderness, you've probably seen pictures, they were just basically a pitch tent with a fabric curtains around it. So it was the tabernacle would not have been as large as this house. The tabernacle area in the Old Testament when they were moving around in the desert and things of this type. But when they get situated in the land under David, David wants to build God a temple, right? And God doesn't let David do it, but he lets his son Solomon, Shlomo, which means peace, shalom, comes from peace. There's going to be peace during Solomon's day. And Solomon is allowed to build a temple. And the temple that Solomon builds is beautiful and impressive, and it's filled with gold, and it's one of the wonders of the world, and people come from all over the world to see the temple. And it was a fairly large institution. Well, it gets destroyed totally because Israel doesn't stay with the program with the Lord by the time we get to the end of the Old Testament. So in the time of the exile, after the kings have all run down, and before we get to Ezra and Nehemiah, before we get to those books, Nebuchadnezzar from Babylon and Assyria, Babylon comes over and conquers Jerusalem, and they start tearing the temple down. They carry off all the golden cups and all the, the chalices and things of this type get carried away to Babylon. And then you have the book of Daniel and Esther, and when Israel is in exile in basically Babylon and Persia. Well, eventually they come back, and then they're allowed to rebuild the temple. And then they rebuild a second temple called the Temple of Zerubbabel. Because Zerubbabel was, that's a fun word to say, sounds like you're doing the ham bone, Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel was a client king. He was sort of placed there by the Persian government and said, you can build a temple. We support that as long as you pray for our Persian government when you're having, church services and things of this type. And that's the way Darius and Cyrus and those folks did that. They believed in letting the local nations have their own religious customs. And so the temple is rebuilt, but it's very modest. It's very meager. It's nothing like a beautiful temple that some would have still remembered. There were people old enough there to have seen Solomon's temple in all its glory. And it says that when they built Zerubbabel temple, some of the people wept for joy, and some of the people wept for sadness. And Zerubbabel's temple was very modest. It wasn't very exciting until closer to the time of the birth of Christ. And then the Palestine, of course, is conquered by the Greeks, and then it's conquered by the Romans. And the Romans appoint Herod, and we talked about Herod the Great. And we'll talk about one of his children this time. There are two Herods in the New Testament. And the one around the birth of Jesus, Herod the Great, is the one who kills the little babies, in Bethlehem. Remember we talked about that. Who wants to know, who's worried that this Jesus, that the Magi, the wise men have come to see. That's Herod the Great. And that Herod the Great was a very famous leader, very capable. And he is the one who tried to befriend the Jews, even though they really didn't like him much, by taking Zerubbabel's temple and doing a massive upgrade on it. He built this gorgeous temple for them. It was just amazing. And that way he tried to earn their good graces. Okay. Well, that Herod dies around the time that Jesus is born. And then one of his children is Herod Antipas, who will be the one that we see at this section of the Bible study that kills John the Baptist, but still has some leadership role in there. Okay, So this temple area, you can see, it takes up probably a full one-eighth of the city. If you look at that in terms of the area in that first map, the thing inside the blue there on the top right, that's the temple precinct. The trapezoidal thing is the temple precinct. And then the building in the middle, that little area in the middle, is the actual temple building. Okay? So it's a very large structure relative to the city. It's, of course, inside the wall of Jerusalem. And that will be the temple area that Jesus will go into, and they will drive out the money changers, and there'll be that famous scene where he does that, and that'll be inside the temple, and it'll be filled with people there for Passover. All the Passover lambs will have to be sacrificed in the temple area for Passover. And they're going to have a major population problem because there'll be 150,000 people converged on this city, and you had to eat the Passover inside the city. We're going to talk about how little the city was in just a minute. So what you had to do was eat it in shifts, you know, and you would eat part of it inside the city at somebody's house, and then you'd go outside the city with your family and have all the celebration thing. Okay, so the temple will be a major point for us. Now, next page has got a scale model, a picture of that temple and the precinct. So that white building there in the middle, of course, is the big temple, that beautiful thing that Herod the Great built for them. And if you look, you'll get an idea of the size by looking at the little models of the people. If you look on the bottom left, you can see the little crowd standing outside the precinct area. And you can see that's quite a large complex of temple area. There's spaces there. The edges, of course, where some Roman troops are going to be. There will be stalls for animals and sacrifices and people of this type through this. And so all of the temple precincts and some of the administration will be inside that complex. All right, now look at the next page. And this will show that white thing in terms of how big it was. So you see somebody has taken that diagram and made a 15-story skyscraper, a modern thing, down on the bottom of that page, and that's how big that temple thing was. If you had a 15-story skyscraper, that's a large building. That's a large building. And a lot of it was just large ceilings, you know, for grandeur, like, you know, Gothic cathedrals, you know, an expanse for holiness and things of this type. So it's a very, very large, beautiful building, and people were so proud of it. And in this last week, even though we won't cover this incident in the last week, when they're going in there, the disciples say, "Aren't these stones and this gold beautiful?" And Jesus says, "I tell you, before this generation passes away, this will all be torn down. Because the Romans will come, about 30 years after Jesus' crucifixion, and tear all this down. They'll finally kick the Jews out of the land," and he says, "there'll not be one stone left upon another." And that's exactly what happened. But it was beautiful, and they were very proud of it. Okay, next page, I have taken that diagram of the city and the temple and superimposed it on an aerial photograph of Leland. All right, so the Google shot below that is Leland. You can see Deer Creek there, the winding thing there, and that's a north-south picture. And so Highway 61, of course, goes right through the middle of that. Our Broad Street, I guess it is, goes right through the middle. But turn to the next picture, which is a little better because I've taken that same diagram and made it transparent so you can see the stuff under it. Okay? So the whole city of Jerusalem fits in a quarter of the city of our town. Okay? And the temple area, if you look there, that gray area, that white thing up to the top left, that's Lazy Boy. Right? That's the Lazy Boy factory out there. So you can see that the temple precinct area, the grounds, was about the size of two of the Lazy Boy, plants stacked side by side. That was the size of the temple area. And the temple itself, the building in the middle of that, if you look directly below that, the temple area, down toward the bottom of the little gray area, and if you look down there, you'll see the track, the school, the Leland High School track there, that little oval that's tilted running just south of East 3rd Street. On this map here, it's right down here. So you'll see on the map, if you see in the gray area, there's this little blue thing, looks like a swimming pool. Well, just to the about a half an inch northeast of that is a little oval track, and that's the that's the school. That's the little track and the little football field that we had there. You know, the practice field there. Does anybody see it? Okay. Yeah. That's the creek. That's Deer Creek. Well, you can see that the building itself was roughly the size of that track. So it gives you the idea of how you know, physically what that would look like. All right. So it's not a large area. Excuse me. It's not a very large area, and all of the events that we're going to talk about happen roughly within that little square. Okay? And when you think of 150,000 people being in and around that city, okay, it's very compressed. It's like Woodstock. Okay? All right, it's a lot of excitement there and rubbing shoulders, you know, and very high density of population for a week. So when the authorities are worried about a riot breaking out, you can understand why. That's why they wanted to take Jesus at night. They wanted to arrest Jesus at night so the crowd wouldn't see it and think, hey, he's our Messiah. And then a riot breaks out and then the Romans come in with their government, you know. And so this will give you an idea of the size. Then the next two charts we won't look at tonight, but we'll discuss. These are two different footsteps of Jesus maps. So that's this one and this one. There are two different ways. The events that we're going to rehearse in just a few minutes, he will celebrate his Passover, his pre-Passover, the night before. He actually dies on Passover as the Passover lamb. So he sort of can't die in the morning and, you know, have Passover that night. So he has a pre-Passover Passover the night before. Then he goes outside the city to the Gethsemane, and then he's going to come back into the city for all the trials. And we will go through these steps, the different ways of where the things happen, how far did they have to walk, you know, what was it like walking from there to there with a crowd of 100 people or 20 people or things of this type, and get a feel for how that works, okay? And then that was those two. And then the last one was a chart we had earlier that was just an aerial map of the city today. And you can see the Dome of the Rock, if you look on the legend there, right in the middle of that Jerusalem legend, it says Dome of the Rock, which is built where the old temple was. So the Dome of the Rock, the Muslim temple, is built on the site of the earlier temple. And they're still part of the wall of the temple building, which is the Wailing Wall, you know, where the Jews, you know, celebrate different things there at the Wailing Wall. Okay, so that's to give you an idea of the size of the area, and then, like I say, we'll look at different parts of the maps as we go through different events, the trial. Where did the high priest live? Well, the high priest had all the money, and so he lived in a real nice area of Jerusalem, and we'll show where that is. He would have had a courtyard in his house Peter would have warmed himself at the fire while he swore up and down that he didn't know Jesus, you know, in front of the little girls and, you know, this kind of thing. And that's the only way it could happen because he was a very wealthy high priest. And we'll talk about the high priest actually next. Okay. So that's early stuff. Now we're going to go actually to the syllabus itself. You have to excuse me for coughing. I took a double cough dose before I got here. And so I'm going to, and I brought my water, so. Okay, so the first thing we're going to do is, like I said, it's a lot of history. I'm going to read through it, but I'm going to explain the background and why there was such animosity between some of these people and why it just boiled over this week in Palestine. All right, so the first one is Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate was a Roman of the upper middle class order. Little is known of his career before A.D. 26, but in that year the Roman Emperor Tiberius, appointed him to be the fifth praefectus of Judea. Evidence of this title was discovered in 1961 on an inscription at Caesarea, and Eve Arderman suggests this title was used in Pilate's earlier years, being replaced by procurator later. All right, time for our first impromptu map. Okay, land of Israel. Remember, some of you will remember this. The land of Israel, this is the Mediterranean Sea, right, Sea of Galilee, and Jordan River. This is obviously not, this is the Dead Sea. There's Jericho, famous Yasser Arafat place, okay. Then Dead Sea is below sea level, the lowest point on the planet. A couple of miles over here is Jerusalem. And the country is divided into three areas. North up here is Galilee. That's got Nazareth and Cana and Tiberias and all the lake where all the storms were, the Jesus and the boats and the fishermen and Peter and James and them are from Galilee. This is Samaria, the country of quote-unquote half-breeds, half-Jewish, half-non-Jews. They hate the Jews. The Jews hate them. The only people that seem to love them are Jesus. Even his disciples have problems with him when they go through there. Want to call fire out of heaven on them, for example. And then this is Judea, from Judah, of course. And if you remember our geography, the distance from the Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea was from what city to what city? From Greenville to Greenwood, right. Roughly 50-something miles. So that's only like a 50-60-mile strip. Pretty small. And then from here over to the Mediterranean Sea was the same distance. Again, so all of biblical history happens within a couple counties. You know, it's very, very small. And all the Holy Week is going to happen in a quarter of Leland. Right? It's all going to happen there. Now, this is all part of a larger area called Syria back in the old days. And Rome conquered Syria. And so Pilate, Pontius Pilate, is over Judea, but Herod is over Galilee. In other words, these are divided up into different sections. And so somebody's got Galilee and part of this over here, and somebody's got Judea and things of this type. So it's parceled out among different different government authorities. Okay? All right, so Pilate is in charge of this area. In accordance with a recent reversal in the policy of the Roman Senate, Pilate took his wife with him to this assignment. Normally they could not take their wives. The government officials that were out in client countries like this had to leave the family at home, a little bit like some diplomats. But they had just reversed this, and so his wife shows up. Lives in Jerusalem, and she actually has a place, a part to play in the Gospels. In the Gospels, and she's of a certain type of religion that we from some of the church fathers say, and that while Pilate is trying Jesus, she sends a message to Pilate and says, "Have nothing to do with that righteous man. I have suffered many things in a dream because of him last night." And Pilate was a little bit superstitious, and his wife was part of that drama that made him pay attention that something odd is going on here. This is not your normal execution and criminal case. So his wife was there with him in a very poorly thought of part of the world. Judea was a backwater place. It was not the most choice plum assignments to get diplomatically. The Jews were known to be troublemakers, you know, and they're famous in the ancient histories for that. They're brilliant. They accomplished everything they do, but they're always wanting more and more privileges from the government, and they always get them. They're excellent negotiators. They get amazing amounts of privileges from the Roman emperors that never let any client countries do that. They were exempted from some of the taxes, and they were allowed to pay their taxes into the temple instead of supporting the government, the Roman government. Amazing. So, and like I say, they're very assertive, and so it wasn't necessarily a choice spot there. As procurator, he had full control in the province, being in charge of the army of occupation, which would have been 120 men of cavalry, and four or five cohorts, which was about 2,500 to 5,000 men of infantry. So that's a fairly large army for something that's, a couple of counties maybe. It's not a very large place, and he's got 5,000 troops, and then cavalry were very premium. You didn't have a lot of horsemen. He didn't need them. They were tremendously powerful. And they were stationed at Caesarea with a detachment on garrison duty at Jerusalem in the fortress of Antonia. Now, Caesarea is a port city right about here along this strip. So Caesarea is this beautiful maritime city named after Caesar. It was built by Herod the Great. When in all those buildings that he did, he built this beautiful city. When you go over to Israel, you see this. There's this gorgeous Greek amphitheater right there out on the water, and you can hear for miles, and it's amazing sets of architecture. And that was where that was the state capital, basically, if you will. And so that's normally where Pilate would have been and spent his time there. When, of course, it was Passover or any of those feasts, everybody had to be on duty, and so he would have his troops there. And along the edges of the temple, when we saw the little walls along the temple area, at the very north end of that was called the Fortress of Antonia. And that was where the Roman guard was to protect public order in the temple area. Okay, they weren't allowed to go into the holy places because that violated all Jewish sensibilities. But one time Paul goes there in the book of Acts, and the Jewish people that don't like him in that particular case want to tear him apart. A riot breaks out in that little temple area. The soldiers that are up on the second floor see this, and they run down and grab Paul and rescue him, thinking he's causing all kind of trouble. So there was a military presence there in the temple, just right along the edge to try to protect public order, the old serve and defend thing, right? The procurator had full powers of life and death and could reverse capital sentences passed by the Sanhedrin, which had to be submitted to him for ratification. In the Sanhedrin, we'll talk about in a few minutes, but that's basically a group of elders. That's like the ruling body of the Jews, and they would want to put somebody to death, and Jewish law, but they had to get it approved by Pilate. Pilate could sit there and say, no, I'm not going to let you kill this guy for just that crime. So he could override the Sanhedrin's death sentence. He also appointed the high priest. Now that's odd, if you think of it. The high priest, remember, was supposed to be descendants of Aaron. If you remember how the high priest got there, remember, during the Exodus, God appointed Moses and Moses' older brother, Aaron, and Aaron was the high priest. And so the high priesthood was supposed to descend through Aaron's children. So it goes from Aaron to Eleazar, Eleazar to Phinehas, and on through the different branches. It goes through Zadok, it goes through Abiathar, it goes through Eli, who gets deposed in the time of the judges and our 1 Samuel. And so it's supposed to be this hereditary thing, but when everything breaks down at the exile, they ended up starting to just buy the office from people. So they bought that from when the Jews were no longer rulers of their own land, and the Persians were, well, you could just go in the Persians and say, boy, I sure would like to be high priest. And speaking of campaign donations, right, I think we can work something out there, David. Mutually beneficial. And that's what happened during between the Testaments, is that the high priestly role became an appointed role. And so Pilate could pick who was the high priest. Boy, you can imagine that the religious purists And the Jews thought this was a little questionable. Not that they could say much about it. I mean, you know, Pilate has absolute authority over this, right? So Pilate appointed high priest. He controlled the temple and its money. The very vestments of the high priest were in his custody and were released only for festivals when the procurator took up residence in Jerusalem and brought additional troops to patrol the city. So, I mean, they had the holy garb, the little costumes, and it was locked up in their palace inside the city, and high priest couldn't get them until it was, you know, time. And so there was a real strong control, and Pilate had a tremendous, you know, power over the religious sensibilities of the people, and as we're going to learn out in a few minutes, he did not exercise that very well at all. Okay, next paragraph. Even pagan historians mention Pilate only in connection with his authorization of the death of Jesus, his only appearance on the stage of history as a procurator of Judea. We don't know anything else about this guy. That's his whole role in history. His 15 minutes of fame is at this trial and his relationship in this political office, which lasted, you know, it lasted a while. It was, you know, several years. But that's all we know about him is from that. Now, Josephus, Josephus is a Jewish historian writing slightly after this period. So he's one of our very close eyewitnesses. He's Jewish. He's a Roman sympathizer. He's very well connected, very educated. He writes a lot of books, histories of the Jews. He defends his people. He writes a series on the wars of the Jews, the antiquities of the Jews, things of his type. And so he's got some very important things to write about all these events. So a lot of the material that we've got comes from him. Josephus relates that Pilate's first action on taking up his appointment was to antagonize the Jews by setting up Roman standards bearing images of the emperor at Jerusalem. Okay, now, previous procurators had avoided using such standards in the holy city. All right, now, when you put up a standard like a banner or a shield that had a Roman emperor, you know, embossed or emblazoned on or something like that, it was always with the signs of divinity. You know, because they were deities. You know, the Roman emperors were like sons of God and all this kind of stuff. And you just did not do this. It was just an effrontery to Jewish sensibilities. Not only were you not supposed to do what the second commandment said, you don't make an image, you don't put a graven image of God at all, much less any of the Roman emperors. And so that was the first thing he did, was he put in there, he just did like you would do it any other country, and nobody would complain. See, nobody would complain about that, right? But he went in there, that's the first thing he did, got everybody upset about that. Because of the determined resistance of their leaders, in spite of threats of death, remember, he just would say, well, shut up, you know, I'll just kill you if you don't like it, you know. I don't have to change it. He yielded to their wishes after 6 days. They pushed so hard that after 6 days, he yielded to their wishes and he removed the images back to Caesarea, which was his place over here on the coast, right? Philo, another Jewish historian, but writing from Alexandria in Europe, in Egypt, rather, tells how Pilate dedicated a set of golden shields in his own residence at Jerusalem. So instead of having it in the public place, he said, well, I'll just have them at home. And so he has it there at his home. And these didn't have an image, but they still had an inscription with the names of the procurator and the emperor. But representations were made to Tiberius, who ordered them to be moved again to Caesarea. So every time he'd try to do something like that, the word would get back to his boss, the emperor Tiberius, and Tiberius would send a little note home that said, he needs to take this home with him. Keep this away from the Jews because we're going to have a problem with this. And, okay, next page. Josephus and Eusebius, and Eusebius is a later historian, he's a Christian historian, allege a further grievance of the Jews against Pilate in that he used money from the temple treasury, remember he was in charge of that, right? He controlled the temple funds, to build an aqueduct, a pipe to convey water to the city from a spring some 40 kilometers away. So he took money out of the collection plate to do plumbing work, you know, for government, you know, for Roman engineers who he would have paid to do this. Now, they would have been locals. They still would have been, the money would have been kept locally. But he took it to build this totally secular thing. Tens of thousands of Jews protest demonstrated against this project when Pilate came up to Jerusalem. presumably at the time of a festival. And in return, he sent his troops in disguise against them so that a large number were slain. It is generally considered that this riot was caused by the Galileans mentioned in Luke 13. Nodius claimed that Herod's enmity against Pilate arose from the fact that Pilate had slain some of Herod's subjects. This explains Pilate's subsequent care to send Jesus to be tried before Herod. So, people from Galilee who weren't citizens of Pilate, when they would come to Jerusalem, see, they were under Herod, but if Pilate kills them when they're there, it's like killing a tourist that's visiting your city, you know, against another country, and that obviously creates problems between Pilate and Herod. And until the night of Jesus' arrest, Pilate and Herod are enemies. Up until that night, they become friends because of one thing that we'll talk about that Pilate and Herod do about Jesus. But they were enemies over this jurisdiction thing throughout this time. Pilate finally overreached himself by the slaughter of a number of Samaritans who had assembled at Mount Gerizim in response of the call to a call of a deceiver who had promised to show them that Moses had hidden the sacred vessels there. Now stop a second. Samaria, remember, right in here in the middle. Mount Gerizim is a famous city, hill in the middle there, in the middle of the place. The Samaritans argue with the Jews over where the most holy place is. The Jews say it's Jerusalem, and the Samaritans say it's Mount Gerizim. They have the rival mountain, right? And so that's the argument, by the way, in John 4. When Jesus goes to the woman at the well, and he's going to try to break into her life and set her free, and he tells us some intimate details about her life that nobody probably knows, and she says to him, "I perceive that you're a prophet. You know something about me. You know, I've been married five times. You know, and the person I'm living with right now is not my husband. You know this. I perceive you're a prophet." You Jews say we should worship in Jerusalem, but we say we should worship in this mountain. She wants to pick a religious fight with him, you know, over this big of an issue. And Jesus defuses that and moves on to something more appropriate, right? Well, in this period, there are a lot of what we call messianic pretenders. There are people that are starting to think this is when God said the Messiah would come. Maybe I'm him. And so we have a number of people that are deceiver types that whip people into a frenzy. And they say, we're going to go do this famous stuff and overthrow the Romans and God's going to bless us because we can tell from the Bible it's time for the Messiah and all this. And this is one of those deceivers that says that Moses is going to show them where Moses hid the famous things. Now, the next sentence explains how somebody doesn't know their Bible. In spite of the obvious falsehood of this claim, because Moses never crossed the Jordan. He never went to Samaria. Remember, when Moses came up, he wasn't allowed to go into the Promised Land. Remember? So he never made it over to that side of Jordan. But these people say, well, Moses was over here, and you hid the things, and I'll show you where they are if you follow me. Right? So just bring a sword with you in case the Romans come. And so nobody obviously knows enough about it, apparently, to think, hey, wait a minute. Moses... Is this the same Moses we're talking about? No, this is Moses Silva. Different, my cousin from Jeroboam. In spite of the obvious falsehood, a great multitude came armed to the mountain, and Pilate surrounded and routed them, capturing many and executing their ringleaders. A Samaritan delegation went to protest with a protest of Vitellius, who was then governor of Syria. Remember I said that Judea and Samaria and Galilee, they were all parts of a larger group called Syria. So this would be Pilate's boss, would be Vitellius. Right? So the Samaritans are really not happy about this, so they sent a protest to Vitellius, who was governor of Syria, and he ordered Pilate to answer this accusation of the Jews before the emperor, ordering Marcellus to Judea in Pilate's place. So He got called on the carpet, and not only did he call before his boss, his boss said, you got to go to Rome and answer before the emperor for this stupidity thing. And so, while you're gone, I'm going to have my friend Marcellus come and be the acting pilot of the area. So Pilate is just not doing a lot of smart things here with these folk. A little heavy-handed, not being smart about this. Pilate was on his journey to Rome when Tiberius died. We know nothing of the outcome of the trial, but Eusebius preserves a report of another otherwise unknown Greek analyst that Pilate was forced to commit suicide during the reign of Gaius, who was a subsequent emperor. So apparently he didn't do well at the trial and wasn't allowed to go back to his job and things of his type. The above incidents are all related by Josephus or Philo. Stauffer draws attention to a further instance of provocation of the Jews by Pilate. According to Hill, the procurators minted small copper coins to meet local needs in Palestine. Normally, these bore symbolic designs of natural features, such as trees and ears of corn, in deference to the Second Commandment. Remember, the Second Commandment says you don't make graven images of famous people and authorities. But in A.D. 2931, Pilate issues coins bearing imperial religious insignia, the litigus or augur's staff, and the patera or pagan libation bowl. So, I mean, he did the worst thing he could possibly do, use symbols of divination, libations. So, and remember, 29 to 31 is roughly the time that Jesus is in ministry. We think that Jesus is actually starting his ministry somewhere around 30 A.D. We think he's crucified around 33. So it's in that space that all this is still happening. Such issues ceased after A.D. 31, and the British Museum has a coin of Pilate on which his successor appears to have overstamped the staff with a palm branch. So they've done a recall of all the little nickels that have got the offensive stuff on it. Somebody with an engraving pen has gone through and changed the staff to something else that's less offensive, right? Although he also did coins with military things to intimidate the Jews as opposed to religious things, which would cause an uproar. Philo can say no good thing to say of Pilate. In one work, he describes him as by nature rigid and stubbornly harsh, a spiteful disposition and an exceeding wrathful man, and speaks of the bribes, the acts of pride, the acts of violence, the outrages, the cases of spiteful treatment, the constant murders without trial, the ceaseless and most grievous brutality of which the Jews might accuse him. The verdict of the New Testament is that he was a weak man, ready to serve expediency rather than principle, whose authorization of the judicial murder of the Savior was due less to a desire to please the Jewish authorities than to fear of imperial displeasure if Tiberius heard of further unrest in Judea. So he was in trouble with his boss. And all he needed was one more, delegation to go to Rome or to his boss and say, God, can you believe what this guy did now? Will you please sack this dude? Right? This is made abundantly evident by his mockery of the Jews in the wording of the superscription. When he writes at crucifixion, we'll talk more about this, you had to put the charge of the accused on the top of the cross, right? And the charge against Jesus was Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, right? And when the Jewish leaders went up to him and said, don't say he's the King of the Jews, say he claimed to be the King of the Jews. And Pilate said, no, I've written. He just did it to irritate them. It wasn't that he was, trying to placate them at all. He was just trying to irritate them, but not so much that they complained to his boss. And so he would still follow through in a mockery, hail King of the Jews, all this kinds of stuff. He was actually being anti-Semitic at the same time. So Pilate, like I say, is not a great Jewish friend so far. In the final comment there on page 3, Pilate's role in the death of Jesus is sort of odd. It's recorded in each gospel, and it was remembered as a historical datum in the preaching of the latter church. In order to secure the conviction and death of Jesus, Caiaphas, who was the high priest at the time and a friend of Pilate, Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin, that group of Jewish leaders, brought their charges to Pilate. While the accusations now took on a political flavor to evoke the governor's interest, he could still find no grounds for condemnation. In the end, Pilate is unexpectedly accommodating, and Jesus is killed. In other words, he tries to let Jesus go four or five times. Can't find anything wrong with him. It's silly, the things they're accusing him of. It has nothing to do with Roman government or his kind of things. But at the end, he just says, okay, let's do it. Why would Pilate act on behalf of the Sanhedrin? Two answers are possible. First, there may have been collusion, cooperation between Caiaphas and Pilate that stemmed from a long-standing relationship and a coterminous rank. In other words, they had their positions for long periods at the same time. 10 of Caiaphas's 18 years in power as the high priest were under Pilate. See, Pilate would have appointed him. And when the prefect, Pilate, was dismissed in AD 36, Caiaphas was also removed the same time. So they were like buddies, fellow villains. Second, if Jesus' trial occurred in AD 33, Pilate may have been concerned about his own impeachment. He had originally been appointed by Sejanus, prefect of the Praetorians in Rome, who had appointed men to colonial office under Tiberius. In other words, he was like a secretary of state to the Rome to Tiberius, and he would have been the one that actually did the appointment of Pilate. But in the autumn of AD 33, Sejanus died. Sejanus was the guy who liked Pilate and picked him, and probably helped him out of trouble with Tiberius sometimes. You know, he'd go in and try to calm things down. Well, his sponsor died. This explains why a Jewish delegation could report directly to Tiberius during that votive shield, you know, when he was putting up those, you know, horrible images. Hence, the charge recorded in John 19:12, if you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend, would have had genuine power over Pilate. Pilate perceived his jeopardy and was anxious to pacify the Jews and please the emperor. This may help to explain an inscription recently found in Caesarea bearing the name of both Pilate and Tiberius in connection with the dedication of a building or temple to the emperor. In other words, not only did it have Pilate's name on it, but it also put his big boss's name on it too. Yes, in a prominent position, so that he's just sort of kissing up, you know, to the boss here to try to help himself there. So Pilate is not known as being politically sensitive, not very mild, easily swayed. He's living in fear toward the time of this week of Jesus' life, trying to maintain some kind of semblance of stability in his life. He's got, a potential riot on his hands with all the Passover people, their thing. So he's going to be a key figure obviously, he's going to be required to do the crucifixion. I mean, the Sanhedrin did not have the authority to do that. So that's Pilate. Now, Pilate he's a Roman, total Roman. And the next guy is Herod. And this is Herod, that's the son of Herod the Great. And Herod is the one that in the 60s when I went off to school, there was a rock, Jesus Christ Superstar. And all I remember, I never saw the thing, but I remember there's some line, the song about Herod wants to see Jesus walk across the swimming pool. I remember that from the music. That's all I remember from the whole rock opera, was just from that. And that Herod was a very superstitious person and wanted to see all these miracles and all this kinds of stuff. And so this is Herod the Tetrarch. And he's the one that's ruling over Galilee. Herod the Tetrarch, who bore the distinctive name of Antipas. So he's called Herod Antipas. He was Herod's younger son by Malthrace. Now, by the way, you're going to see in here that this family is one of the most dysfunctional families you have ever seen. They're all married inside the family. They're all betraying one another. Remember Herod the Great, when we did the Nativity, remember Herod the Great was the one who killed several of his own children. And so we had that joke that where the Emperor Tiberius had said, it was safer to be Herod's pig than to be Herod's son, because you couldn't kill a pig in Judea, you know, because of the Jewish thing and the pork, and you know. But he was killing his own sons. Remember? Well, this is one of the sons that survived all of that. He was Herod's younger son by Malthrace, and inherited the Galilean and Perean portions of his father's kingdom. In the Gospels, he is conspicuous chiefly for his part in the imprisonment and execution of John the Baptist. That's his main claim to fame. And for his brief encounter with Jesus when the latter was sent to him by Pilate for judgment during the Holy Week. Jesus is recorded as having once described him as that fox. He was the ablest of Herod's sons, though. He was the best of the litter. And like his father, was a great builder. The city of Tiberias on the Lake of Galilee was built by him. And that's the city that you go when you go over to see, you know, where Jesus walked. And that's the city of Tiberias you stay at there on the Sea of Galilee. He built that and named it in honor of the Emperor Tiberius. He married the daughter of the Nabatean king, Aretas IV, but divorced her in order to marry Herodias, the wife of his half-brother, Herod Philip. Okay, now, Nabataeans live down here. They're a desert kingdom down in this part of Jerusalem, of Palestine. And the famous rock fortress Petra is part of their kingdom. It's in that area. They're mostly Edomites. They're descendants of Esau. There's generally a hostility between them and the Jews. But for a political alliance, Herod, who is half Edomite himself, does a political marriage with this daughter. Well, he falls in love with somebody he sees at family reunions, apparently, is the wife of his half-brother, Philip. And so he divorces this political thing, which you don't ever do, you know, unless you want to go to war with the father-in-law. I mean, that's the way you break off alliances, is you divorce the political marriage. He divorced her in order to marry Herodias, the wife of his half-brother, Herod Philip. Herod Philip, by the way, is a ruler of this area north of Galilee. So Herod's got Galilee, and his half-brother Philip has got way up here on northeast of the Sea of Galilee. according to the synoptic evangelists, that's Matthew, Mark, and Luke, John the Baptist incurred the wrath of Antipas for denouncing the second marriage as unlawful. Says it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. Okay. Josephus says that Antipas was afraid that John's great public following might develop into a revolt. So he was afraid of John the Baptist because everybody loved John the Baptist. Nobody did not love John the Baptist. He is probably the most famous Jewish figure of that period. Excuse me. He was afraid that that was going to be another revolt, right? Because, I mean, he might have just got a following, and they're not on my payroll. They're dangerous. Aretas naturally resented the insult offered to his daughter and seized the opportunity a few years later to wage war against Antipas. The forces of Antipas were heavily defeated, and Josephus records that many people regarded the defeat as divine retribution for Antipas' killing of John the Baptist. Remember, John the Baptist has got that famous story of where he throws this party for all his governors, and his niece, Herodias' daughter, comes in and does the little belly dancing thing or whatever, and he's so impressed that he makes an oath, up to a third of my kingdom, whatever you ask for, I'll give you. And so the little girl goes to ask his mother, Herodias, the mother, what should I ask for? And she says, I want the head of John the Baptist on the platter. That's that story. Okay. And so he goes in, and Herod doesn't like killing John the Baptist because John the Baptist is in prison, but he's so superstitious, he's scared to death of this and the revolt and everything. But he has to do it because of his promise and dinner guests and losing face and stuff like that. And so he does it. So then when he hears about Jesus doing miracles, guess what Herod says? This is John the Baptist risen from the dead. I knew it was going to come back to get me. And all the people said that's why he was defeated by Aretas, because he killed good John the Baptist. In AD 39, Antipas was denounced to the Emperor Gaius by his nephew, turned him in, as a plotter, and he was deposed from his tetrarchy, and it ended his days in exile. So a member of his own family turned him in. And then the turnabout fair play, the last paragraph on the next page, or page 4 at the top, the only important event recorded early in Antipas' reign was the downfall of his brother Archelaus in A.D. 6. So remember, Herod had a lot of kids, and one of Herod's brothers was Archelaus, one was Philip, but Archelaus in A.D. 6. This was accompanied when he, Herod, his brother Philip, whose wife he stole, and a Jewish and Samaritan delegation went to Rome to complain about his rule to Tiberius. So they gang up and they go complain about their brother to Tiberius, and that's how Archelaus ends up getting killed, executed, because his brother and his brother Philip turned him in. Antipas remained a tetrarch. He was unable to obtain the dynastic title Herod, which was of great significance both to his subjects and to the political and social services of the Roman world. Tiberius may have given him this title in lieu of the coveted title king. Herod the Great, which was at the birth of Jesus, he was King Herod. And all his sons wanted to be King Herod. But none of the Roman emperors gave any of them the king title, but he allowed them to be called Herod. And Herod was like Caesar, like the name Caesar. It meant more than just a personal name, like Julius Caesar. And so Herod was like a dynastic name. And so he would have just been called Antipas otherwise, but it was sort of like, you can't be king, but I'll let you get halfway there and we'll call you Herod after your dad's title. And so that's Herod. So Herod is superstitious. He's a great builder. The Jews like him a lot more than they do Pilate. But then again, he doesn't do a lot of stuff with the Jews. He's up in Galilee, right? He'll come to Jerusalem because all the Galileans will come to Jerusalem for the feast. So every time they come, guess where he's going to come? He's going to come there with his subjects in case trouble brews. And so that's our two major political leaders, Pilate and Herod. Now, this next group are the Sadducees. And the Sadducees, we don't know a lot about. That's why we've got a little bit, just very little bit on them. But they show up in the Gospels. Josephus identifies the Sadducees as one of the three varieties of Judaism that existed during the Maccabean period. So this is, Maccabean period is sort of between the, right before we get to the New Testament. And there are three groups that Josephus talks about. There'll be the Pharisees, that we see a lot of. The Sadducees, we see a little bit of. And the Essenes, which we don't see any of in the New Testament, but they're the people who did the Dead Sea Scrolls, who we'll talk about. They were influential, and we'll talk about them. The Sadducees. Josephus tells us that the Sadducees, one, rejected the concept of fate. So they didn't believe that God had predestined certain events and things that there was a plan for history. They accepted the idea of free will so that God could not be held responsible for evil. They did not believe that the soul exists after death. So when you died, it was over. And they did not believe that there were rewards and punishments after one died. Okay, so not only is there no heaven or hell, there's no resurrection to get back in your body for you to get a reward or a punishment. See? So it just ends at death for them. Now, I remember when I was writing some of this down, but I was thinking, why would they believe this? Well, the Sadducees were the rich people. See, if the only rewards that you got, if the only proof that you were good was that you were rich, if all your rewards were in this life, right, then by definition, the poor are evil, right, and the rich are the only good ones. And so it's a perfectly consistent belief. You know, it makes perfect sense. That's why I'm so rich, because I'm so good. You know, and so it makes perfect sense that they were being rewarded for their goodness now. Josephus also mentions that the Sadducees observed nothing apart from the law, which is the Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament, and that they considered it a virtue to dispute with their teachers. They liked to argue. He further states that the Sadducees did not have the support of the masses, that they only enjoyed the, quote, confidence of the wealthy. See, they weren't popular with the masses. You know, they were aloof, you know, a little elitist. But the wealthy liked them because they obviously had mutual interest, self-supporting interest. And that only a few men of the highest standing knew the Sadducean doctrines. They only taught, you know, the aristocracy. He claims that the Sadducees were boorish and more heartless than other Jews. He claims that the Sadducees frequently accepted Pharisaic doctrine. He names only one high priest, Ananias, as a Sadducee. And Ananias will be the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who is the high priest that will condemn Jesus. So they'll be players in this thing. The New Testament considers the Sadducees' rejection of resurrection as their primary characteristic, for the issue of resurrection was central to the early church. The Gospel of Mark does not place the Sadducees in opposition to the Pharisees, and Matthew often places them together as if they were two similar groups. Luke mentions the Sadducees only in his discussion of resurrection. John, Gospel of John, does not mention the Sadducees. Only in Acts do we find the two groups disagree. However, the disagreement centers only on the issue of resurrection. While some Sadducees seem to be attached to the temple, the New Testament does not equate them with the priest or the priests with them. Now, the priests, remember, were Levites, but the high priests were these political appointees. And the high priest, most of the high priests that we know of are Sadducees. They're this wealthy aristocracy, rubbing hobnobbing with the rich and famous and the Romans. And they have a lot of authority in the temple area because of the high priest. So that's our Sadducees. They're going to show up as one of the groups that condemns Jesus. And then the group that everybody loves to hate, the Pharisees. But all three source collections, the New Testament, Dead Sea Scrolls, and all of our sources, basically, although they understand the Pharisees differently, support the conclusions that they were a lay and not a priestly association who were thought to be expert in the laws. In other words, they weren't priests, they weren't clergy. They were just like lay leaders. They were like Bible teachers, traveling expert Bible teachers that really knew what they were talking about, but they weren't ordained, they weren't in some kind of priestly role or any kind of a job function like that. They were, in a sociological sense, brokers of power between the aristocracy and the masses. That means that if the aristocracy would try to win over the Pharisees to go sell their agenda to the masses, because the aristocracy would not be able to convince the poor people to play with the program, but the Pharisees, who were not official appointees, you know, maybe if they could talk them into it, maybe they would convince them. And then they would broker powers in the back because they would represent the masses to the aristocracy, sort of like a labor union. So they would be like collective bargaining, and they would try to, you know, well, we're going to have a riot here if you guys don't, you know, do this, right? So they promoted a special living tradition in addition to the biblical laws. They were interested in issues of ritual purity and tithing. They believed in an afterlife, judgment, and a densely populated, organized spirit world. Now, the main thing in that paragraph there is what they believed in was a separate set of revelation. Remember how God gave Moses the law. And in the Old Testament, it represents that Moses wrote the Bible down. He wrote all of the commandments of God down, that everything was written on the scrolls and the Torah, and it was put inside the Ark of the covenant. Right? It was all put in there. And that was all that what God told him. The Pharisees believe, however, that in addition to written laws, God gave them oral laws to Moses, too. And Moses didn't write those down, but passed them down in unbroken succession through all the little rabbis to the Pharisees, and they were the only ones that knew the real rules, the extra rules, the tradition of the elders, Jesus calls it, and which, oddly enough, sometimes contradicts the written law when it's inconvenient. So this living tradition, this oral law, this halakha, the Jews call it, traditions that are in addition to the Hebrew Bible, is what a lot of the controversy between Jesus and the Pharisees will be about. Because he'll know what the Old Testament law said because he wrote it as God. And then they'll have an interpretation with their oral law that's different than that. Okay, so let's go to page 5 now. What could be learned of the Pharisees from a comparison of the sources? First, the Pharisees were the rivals of the Sadducees. Sadducees were rich, They had the political appointments. They had the insides with Pilate. And the Pharisees had only the support of the masses. And they could try to talk you, try to impress you by being experts in the law. They were smart, scholar types. And so they would try to use expert power to overcome you. At the time of the ministry of Jesus, the Pharisees were the leading party and held so much influence over the common people that the Sadducees were often forced to conform to the Pharisaic practice. In other words, they just had to go with it because they had so much political appeal. Second, the Pharisees in the New Testament are definitely a group distinct from the scribes, although some Pharisees were scribes. Now remember, a scribe is just nothing more than a lawyer and somebody who could write. So somebody knew how to write, somebody could do a lot. They were like a notary public. You know, they had seals, they could do transactions. Some of the priests, you know, were scribes, and some of the scribes were priests, but not all of the scribes were priests. Some of those would have been like carpenters during the day, and scribes at night. You know, it was a second occupation. Some of the scribes, however, are specialists in interpreting the laws, and so they become more like lawyers. And so people will go to the scribes, and Jesus will fuss about the scribes. He says, people come to you for a decision, and you'll interpret the law so minutely and so harshly that you'll load burdens on men's backs, and you won't lift a finger to help them with that load. You weigh them down with all this minutiae, legal minutiae, when the law is a thing of freedom. And so they have some power, but they're not all Pharisees. The lack of complete synonymity is also reflected in the rabbinic literature, where they're often found as separate groups. Third, the Pharisees follow and perpetuate an oral law. This was what we were talking about, key point. The tradition of the elders, which they believed had also come from Moses. For example, they believed in the resurrection of the body, a concept, among others, that the Sadducees rejected, right? In addition, the Pharisees followed a strict system of religious practices. They fasted. They made proselytes, which are disciples. They prayed. They tithed their goods. There were ranks among their members, including those who were initiates and those who were leaders. There were scribes. There were some priests. They sent out deputations to examine individuals who did not conform to their policies or doctrine. So they would send like a group from the church, that when they suspected that you were a heretic. And they would go out and they would convene a little court in your village and ask you what you believed and what you were teaching. And they were like, you know, an Inquisition kind of thing. But they were zealous for their vision of Judaism and on occasion ruthlessly opposed their enemies, real or imagined, by means of bribery, incarceration, or executions. Even while the Pharisees had dominant status, they came under increasing criticism. Anti-Pharisaic sentiment is associated with various passages in the Gospels, especially Mark 23. Severe criticism, however, is also found in some of the documents from Qumran and in the rabbinic literature. You have to remember that these are zealous people. I mean, they study the law. They're the ultra orthodox. And if you don't play with their program, you need to be thrown in jail until you repent or be guilt or exiled out of the land. The Apostle Paul was a Pharisee. He was raised as a Pharisee. He was Rabbi Saul of Tarsus until he became Apostle Paul. And so he knows Pharisees inside and out. He was the one that they sent from Jerusalem to a city to imprison the Christians. And so they're a very strong group. They're very pure, zealous. They would not eat with sinners. And this was one of the main arguments they had with Jesus. Jesus would hang out with people like us, but the Pharisees wouldn't. The Pharisees would have their potluck, but they would say, no sinners allowed. Okay, no sinners allowed. And you had to be one of them and carry their card and wear their badges, and there or you couldn't get in, and there was no halfway house. It was an all or none. And so the tax collectors didn't have a chance at it, you know, and things of this type. So they were an exclusive group, and they were trying to convert everybody to their way of doing it. Now the Qumran community is the Dead Sea Scrolls. Remember? Historically, where they come, just in a paragraph, As the different, as these Sadducees and the Pharisees and all these different groups are growing up, they're developing within Judaism, you know, before the birth of Jesus. As this, when it comes back in the land after Babylon and they come to power and they get you know, under control of the Romans, and Rome gives them freedom, well, they start developing all these denominations, Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes, there's a whole bunch of these, and they're arguing among themselves, stuff like this. Well, occasionally somebody will say, well, you guys are so bad, we're going to break off from your church, and we're going to, as a matter of fact, you've just messed up the whole temple, we're going to move out of your defiled city, Jerusalem, and we're going to find us our own place and call it the New Jerusalem. And so this group of the Essenes, they moved out to the Dead Sea. And so there's this groups of these caves out here. And they had this whole great big complex where they had their worship. And, they, you know, it was like just a break-off communion. And they were waiting for the Lord to return and set them up as the, you know, replace the old priest and put them in place in Jerusalem after he cleaned it up. And that's the Qumran community and the Dead Sea Scrolls. And they write this. And that's why they're called the Dead Sea Scrolls. Well, in their literature, they're very critical, as you can expect, of the Pharisees. And all the people that are running this corrupt temple establishment, that's who they broke off from. And so they call them all kind of really foul names. Sons of Belial, sons of Satan, and, you know, all these things. And they're code words, so they can't be arrested. But the Qumran community rejected Pharisaism because it frequently nullified the law while trying to protect it from transgression. If the Damascus document is an Essene product, which was written over there in the Dead Sea Scrolls, then those described in this document who presented false expositions may well be the Pharisees and the Pharisaic scribes of Jerusalem. Similarly, another document speaks of those who seek to exchange the teaching of God for smooth words. The teaching of God was hard, but they made it smooth. Hillel established a legal formula that in effect annulled the law of remission in Deuteronomy 15:2. Such an exegesis, aimed more at circumventing the text than expounding it, represents precisely what the anti-Pharisaic criticism of the Zadokites called a deceitful exposition of the Torah. All right? What that means is Deuteronomy 15:2 said that in the year of Jubilee and on the seventh year, if there were debts, you were supposed to forgive. You were supposed to let the debts go. You're supposed to forgive all the debts. It was like, you know, wiping away the credit record and the debts for your Jewish brothers that were, that owed you a lot of money. There was this remission of debts. A lot of governments in the ancient world had those periods, by the way. But this was a law that God built in Deuteronomy that said you could not, once you got through with the Jubilee, you could not try to claim that debt against your Jewish brother. Well, Hillel came up with a reading of that where you could. Just directly contradicted what the law said, the written law. And he came up with this real clever, you know, sophisticated theological argument and nullified the law. And this is exactly what one of Jesus' main criticism about this, about how you nullify the Word of God with your tradition. And many such things you do. Okay, so the next paragraph. The New Testament criticism of the Pharisees is in some ways similar to that from Qumran. Jesus accused the Pharisees of being blind guides. He also rebuked them for nullifying the Word of God by means of their tradition, closing his remarks with, "And many such things you do." Apparently, he could have given other examples other than the Korban issue, in which Pharisaic Halakha, which is that oral tradition, contradicted the intended meaning of Scripture. Right? The law said, honor your father and mother. So what this meant was, in the world where all the families lived together, you would have three or four generations in the same house, that when ownership of the business or something passed to the next generation, you were supposed to take care of your parents. They're retired. They're still living in the house. They own the house. And you're still supposed to support them and take care of them. And you're supposed to do that. And so the parents had already set aside their money for you to take care of them with. That's the way it worked. You know, they put money aside. Their retirement was turned over as an executor to the kid. But it was the money that they were supposed to spend on the parents. You know, you'd put money aside for your retirement kind of thing, medical expenses, right? Well, these guys in the New Testament said, well, If you want a really high calling, you can take that money that's set aside for your parents, and you can call it Korban, a gift to God. And you can donate it to the treasury, the temple treasury, and it'd be better than taking care of your parents because you're giving the money to God. And that, this obviously did not make Jesus happy. So Jesus said, you completely reverse the point of the law in this Korban thing. With your oral tradition is what that was. It was an oral thing. They said Moses said it was okay. He just didn't write it down. And there was no way you could prove that, see? Because it was just word of mouth passed down. And Jesus said, and many such things you do with your law. So a lot of his arguments with the Pharisees were not over Scripture. It's over just the extra laws that they had made up as they went through. Okay? Now, I think that's all we're probably going to do with the Pharisees. Let's see. Let's see, on page 6, just that last paragraph. When I say the Pharisees were the ones that everybody loved to hate. Of all these groups, when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem and kicked the Jews out of the land between 70 and 130 AD, the only group that survived were the Pharisees. Obviously, when you overthrow the government, you know, when the Rome comes in and destroys all your political power, guess who's going? Your aristocracy, your high priest, your Sadducees. You know, those are who loses all the property. It's those the popular folks, they ain't got no money. The Pharisees, you know, they're the people that are left. They all move up to Galilee, and they become the rabbis of Judaism. So the Pharisees are the ones that are the forerunners of the rabbis of all the Jewish holy literature. The Torah, not Torah, but the Talmud and the Mishnah and all of the Jewish books that they read are written by the descendants of the Pharisees. Okay? But even the descendants of the Pharisees are not sure they like being called Pharisees, as you can see from here. Criticism of the Pharisees in the rabbinic literature is neither as sharply focused or as plentiful as that in the other places, since, however, the rabbis who rebuilt Judaism after the fall of Jerusalem seem to have avoided associating themselves with the name Pharisee, embarrassment on the part of these direct heirs of the spiritual legacy of Phariseeism calls for an explanation. And if you want to read that next paragraph, you can, but it just describes that there's seven kind of Pharisees, five of which are really bad, two of which are good, but the rabbis in the rabbinic literature don't associate themselves well with the Pharisees. And some of the more famous and beautiful-hearted rabbis describe that before they became rabbis, how much they hated the Pharisees, and then they became one. And then abandoned Phariseeism and became just regular rabbis. So the Pharisees end up being, you know, a problem. They're elitist, you know, they make the little people feel unworthy, you know, tax collectors, and they block people off from getting to God, basically. The teaching, you know, it's only if you come to my clean house and, you know, and things of this type. And so they're a problem for Jesus, and we'll see the conflict in that last week in his life, it's a major problem for that. Well, we're halfway through, and it's 8:30, and we're going to have to stop here and then just resume when we get to the next one. So we only have two more background groups, and they're pretty, we've covered a lot of those, and then we'll actually get into the individual sessions, and it'll go a little bit faster when I don't have to fill in all the, you know, the historical background on that. But you can see how the players are starting to shape up, and they're all going to be there at Passover. They've all got different agendas, and they're all jockeying for power, and none of them know what to do with Jesus. Because Jesus is right out of the blue. He comes in there. He's got a different agenda. He doesn't support the aristocracy. He doesn't support the Pharisees. The only people he seems to hang out with are sinful people who are honest and tax collectors. And he even heals servants of the Roman centurions. In other words, he's got no standards who he hangs out with and helps and heals and who he loves. And so there's going to obviously be a problem with the status quo, and that's where he's going to bring that to a head deliberately and call them, and the next time we get together, he's going to call them to trying to decide where they stand. Do they want the way they've got it, which doesn't work, doesn't help folk, and they're in, you know, they were never supposed to be under the control of another foreign government. God said in the Old Testament, He says, if you just walk with me in beauty and grace, you will be the head of all the nations and not the tail. But if you decide that you want to go in these other directions and do all and be like all the other nations, as bad as they are, then somebody else will be ahead over you until you learn. And you will be the tail. And He's going to come in here and He's going to give them the opportunity that says that basically if you would have known what would have made for your peace this day that I come in. But now it's hidden from your eyes. And none of it, and all of this will be destroyed in this generation. And we'll try again later. I'll return some other time later. So He'll come and He'll offer all these people freedom and what they've longed for. And it'll be like the, like us in our lives, where, you know, the old dog and the new tricks. Now, it's not that we don't believe that new tricks won't work. Excuse me, that we can't learn them. It's just that we don't think may not work any better than the old tricks. And so the opportunities, He's going to come up and He'll call all of us, just like He called all of them, said, yeah, you can have the status quo if you're perfectly happy with that right now, but if you want something a little more, and listen to me and let me be the leader and take a little more leadership authority and learn from me, and for my yoke is gentle and my heart is gentle. So we'll look at the interaction of these. For, like I said, next time we'll try to get cover a little bit more ground. I'll be able to talk a little faster when I don't have to cough as much. And, so I will warn you ahead of time for that. So let's close with a word of prayer here. Father, we do thank You for Your love, and we thank You for the fact that You don't mind getting Your hands dirty in helping us, that You came to earth in the person of Your Son and walked into this situation. In many ways, these conflicts of these peoples, this was a no-win scenario. I mean, it was getting Your hands dirty. It was going to be eventuate, of course, in becoming sin for us on the cross as the only means of our freedom. And a freedom not from government, but a freedom from ourselves, the limitations of ourselves. We thank You for these precious souls here tonight, eager to learn and grow and learn more about Your Son and Your Word and the mystery of this Holy Week and the amazing things that occurred and the constancy of Your love and Your passion that when You went through all the way through the garden, that You went through all these confrontations, that You went all the way through the cross out of that love. So we ask that You would help everyone here, give them a good week, bring them safely back together next week, and that You'd stir these things around in our minds, Lord, that we might see things clearly as, you know, see new things this week in our lives. Your hand as You try to walk into our city, into our heart and our lives more and more, and confront us with hope of change and hope of newness and hope of healing and hope of warmth and hope of joy and hope. And we ask that You would bless this for Your purpose in honor of Your Son. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.